Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Jake, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. Would you mind introducing yourself to everyone out there listening?
Sure, Jake S. Friedman, animation historian and author of books like The Disney Revolt.
Now, how'd you become an animation historian?
I was a nerd. When I was a teenager, I was a nerd, and I just started picking up books. I was a nerd in the 90s before internet time, so books was all we had, and I just got a bunch of books on like the making of this book or this movie and like behind the scenes that movie, and I tried to get my hands on as many behind the scenes anecdotes as possible. And I was also I'm not based in LA. I was living in Philadelphia when I was a kid, so it wasn't like I could, you know, just meet film people on the streets. I just books was my way into the makings of film, and picked up a bunch of flip books. Just loved animation, practiced animation myself, wanted to become an animator, did become an animator. But really, it was just finding as many behind-the-scenes books as possible. Seamus Culhane had written two books on animation called Animation from Script to Screen, which is basically a how-to guide up to that time, which was the 80s. And he wrote a book called Talking Animals and Other People, which is his sort of his memoir of working in the animation world, starting at in like New York City studios in the 20s and then moving to Disney in the 30s. And that was just fascinating because this is a book about a guy who worked at Disney. He was a top animator at Disney, and this was not a Disney book. So he tells stories and he mentions names that Disney was not talking about at that time. No Disney published book had these stories. It wasn't until relatively recently, like the last 20 years, that Disney talked about things like the strike. And even now, Disney has a very tender touch whenever it mentions stuff about the strike, and it'll be mentioned here and there.
I think I noticed it in your book. There's a discrepancy from based on what Disney says, how long the strike lasted.
So the strike actually lasted 9 weeks. It lasted from late May to early August. So it had been misreported before because I guess it was hard to get the records down. And the Disney archives has been very careful about what records they let out. So the strike lasted 9 weeks. Other sources say five. Other sources, it often says five. Some sources say seven. But after spending about 10 years researching this, I'm confident in putting the number nine.
Now, when did the strike start, and what did it consist of? Like, were the conditions dealing with the animators, a pay gap?
Oh man, I wrote a whole book to answer that question. I can't answer that in one sentence. What did the strike consist of? Do we talk about the politics of Hollywood at the time? There was
if you want to talk about pre Hollywood, we can.
Okay, Hollywood. During the Great Depression, Great Depression, the Roaring 20s led to the Great Depression. During the 20s, everyone was feeling pretty financially stable, and union life and union petitioning had gone drastically down from the 19 teens. You know, lots of unions were cropping up in the teens. Famously, we had like over in New York, where I'm speaking to you now, we had the Garment Workers Union, which was very strong in the teens. But when the economy kind of like had this big boom in the 20s, union talk kind of went down because less need for a union when all the employees are happy. And then the Great Depression made union talk come back up again, sort of like how it's coming up again now. I mean, I hear people talking about lots of union talk has been coming up these last few years, which is kind of exciting.
Well, no, it's similar if people start questioning if capitalism's the way to go still.
right. So, and how much government should be involved and how much should there be a free market, you know? And that was a real conundrum of a question. How much should government be involved? And so when President Roosevelt took office, he wanted the government to be greatly involved. He wanted the government to create programs to alleviate the depression and to create jobs. And the majority of the members of the Supreme Court said, no, that is unconstitutional. The government should not step in and be involved. We should leave it up to the states. And so thankfully, his bills got passed like 5-4, like barely squeaked by. And so he was able to create these plans that were part of the New Deal. And part of that was the right to have unions. And Hollywood was a big proponent of that. I mean, everywhere, really. But Hollywood is probably the most fascinating because I guess it was always considered to be a luxury industry because it's not like you're making things that people require, like, I don't know, clothes.
Yeah.
You're making movies. But movies are part of our cultural fabric and they're part of, I guess, our mental health, too. We need some fantasy to escape. And so little by little, all these crafts in Hollywood started unionizing. We know the Screen Actors Guild, that was first. We had Screenwriters Guild, Screen Directors Guild. In my book, I have like a list of all these unions. Like it fills nearly a page of just acronyms of all these unions. Besides writers and directors, you had office workers, you had camera operators, you had background painters. Every craft you can think of in Hollywood.
Were you surprised at the number of people that were coming together and unionizing in this way? Because I knew about the Screenwriters Guild, maybe a couple of others, but you're making it sound like there's a lot more. So I'm like, I'm wondering if there's a lot more out there that just don't get really talked about.
Yes, I was. And I spent a lot of time with old copies of the Variety magazine, the trade magazine Variety, just on microfilm, just in the LA library, just looking at page after page of every issue from like 1939 through 1941. And there's union talk in like every page of Variety in this time. There's this union and that union. This union is threatening with a strike, and that union has been accepted by the studio head. And it's just like every craft needs its union, and every union needs to be ratified by the local labor board. And once it's ratified, it has to be accepted by the studio head. So there are lots of steps before a union can actually be like functional in a studio or in any workplace. And once it's accepted by the studio head, great. Problem solved. If it's not accepted by the studio head, then there's always a threat of a strike. And it just blew my mind how many strike threats there were. It seemed to be sort of like a wild card they would threaten with and never really make good on the threat. It was just a tactic, like a blowhard tactic. Very rarely did a strike actually erupt. And that's part of what made the Disney strike so significant, is that they were threatening with a strike for many months. Meet us, Walt. Meet with us so that we can figure this out. That's really all that they wanted at that point. They wanted Walt to meet with us with the union committee, and Walt and his vice president just refused to have talks with the heads of the animation union. And so, as a result, the strike happened. But it was a buildup over years, from like 1938 through 1941. It was just a buildup and bad blood that went from being very cordial and cooperative to being just bumping heads fiercely against each other, and each person just saying the other one's a villain. It was just like this tiny crack that turned into a wide crevasse between these two sides. It's just kind of a shame how that happened.
Now, was that from a neglect? Like, did Walt know what was going on at the time? Did he know that his workers were demanding certain wages or just certain advantages that they feel like they were owed, and he just wasn't paying attention to them? Or was that just maybe a lack of caring? Because Disney did expand so quickly, so I would think if you're a guy running a company with a bunch of people under you, you're probably less focused onto the ground stuff and more focused into probably what's going on in your mind or just some certain transactions.
Yeah, to say that Walt Disney ran the company is not entirely true. The name is the Walt Disney Studios, right? But it was really co-owned by him and his brother. It was called the Disney Brothers Studio up until the name change, but it was still, you know, a bi-partnership between Walt and Roy, his brother. And they had this vice president named Gunther Lessing, who was a major factor in every decision they were making. Not only was he the vice president, he was the chief lawyer that had been working with Walt since like Steamboat Willie days, who signed on to the payroll on the 1st of January, 1930. But he had been working sort of freelance with Walt to sort of like protect his copyright of Mickey Mouse. Funny we say that now that Steamboat Willie's in the public domain.
Yeah.
So I think of the company as being operated by Walt on the creative side, Roy on the business side, and their vice president, Lessing, Gunther Lessing, on the legal side. So these three people are sort of trying to run all aspects of the company. And Walt is just concerned with making the creative stuff work, making fun movies, making good shorts, making characters that last, that can actually sell products. Merchandising is big. That's where Gunther Lessing steps in, merchandising Mickey Mouse and stuff. And Roy, his job is how to get money for these very expensive projects, how to get funding, how to hire the right people, and how to let go of the wrong people. And Gunther Lessing, he was the person, he was the forward-facing face of anything legal, including union activity. So when there was talk initially about starting a union at Disney, Gunther Lessing was the face of the company for those people. And he was the person who was just like staunchly against any independent union coming in to tell the company how they should run. Almost like he was acting independently of Walt, but kind of leaning into what he suspected Walt wanted. Walt himself valued loyalty to the utmost degree. If you watch the movie Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, the original 1937, you'll see that in the title card, the first title card that has like a note directly from Walt Disney, he signs his name on this title card. He says he thanks his studio and all the tireless artists who worked on this film for their loyalty and hard work. And it's interesting that he names these two qualities, and of those two qualities, he puts loyalty first. So loyalty is super important to Walt. And Gunther Lessing kind of leaned into that predilection that Walt had to sort of stay on Walt's good side, and kind of painted unions as being disloyal to a company. And if you talk to any people who study unions, you'll find that unions strengthen companies, that once you have happy workers who feel secure, turnaround cuts down significantly, and turnaround's expensive for a company. Happy workers create better product, and that's beneficial for a company. And it's just a way to have like a collective bargaining voice, so any grievances can be brought up. Any company is kind of reliant. I thought about this a lot because I wasn't such a big union guy until I started this project, until I started working on this book. My parents were part of a teacher's union when I was a kid, so I always had kind of like a fond place in my mind for what a union is, but I didn't really know the ins and outs of it. But any company depends on three, maybe four legs to stand on: management, who runs it, the customers, who buy the goods or services, sometimes the like people who own the stock, and the employees. You can't have a business without any of these three things: employees, management, and customers. Well, management can voice their desire for change easily because they're at the top of the heap. The customers can voice with the dollar, either buy or not buy, and then you get their input. There's no other way for the employees to voice their any sort of grievances than to have like a grievance committee. And what brings about a grievance committee, a union? You just have some person to say, this is what the workers need to be happy. You know what the managers need to be happy. You know what the shareholders need to be happy. You know what the customers need to be happy. How do you know what the employees need to be happy? So really just getting a grievance committee in is the main job of a union. And that helps any company thrive if the company is willing to hear it.
Now, what were the demands of some of the employees? Like, was it something drastic? Was it just too much? Like, why wasn't it so easily given if it was going to create more loyalty with, or at least strengthen your company by having your employees get back to work?
The first thing they wanted was just the right to organize. It started out as a fear. Since you talked about like American history, during the 1930s, the mafia was creeping into unions. It happened.
Jimmy Hoffa, best example. That man taught me about unions.
Right? You need a hook to get you interested in this. But it's interesting because they needed the mafia, the organized crime syndicate, needed some sort of like big win. Prohibition had just ended. Prohibition had just ended, and they needed something else to get in on. Well, unionism. The rules were very lax. It was kind of a very new organization, a very new branch of the government. And that's when Al Capone's guys decided, oh, this is where we can get our next big score. Unions. There's like no sanctions anywhere. No sanctions. We'll just do whatever the hell we want. So they realized that if they sign up a bunch of, let's say, camera operators in Chicago to their, you know, air quotes, union, and then tell the theater owners, hey, all of your camera operators are going to go out on strike unless you pay me $10,000. Then they're going to get $10,000 from the guy who owns AMC or the guy who owns Lowe's. So pay the guy who owns Lowe's pays this, you know, mafia union guy $10,000. And now their cameras are going to work again and play the movies. So that's what the mafia wanted to do. Blackmail studio heads. And this one guy whose real name, I kid you not, is Willie Bioff in Chicago. He gets into this racket. And then the Al Capone guys get a wind of what Willie Bioff is doing. And they say, you know, how about this, buddy? You work for us. You get one third of the cut. And we'll empower you to get not 10 grand, but hundreds of grand. Hundreds of thousands of dollars from the big boys down in Hollywood. Get out of Chicago. We'll make you a representative for a big union down in Hollywood. And he's like, sure, sign me up. This was a small potatoes guy who was just like, who found himself playing with the big boys of Al Capone's gang.
And I will just say Bioff, and then there's Bernie Madoff. I mean, the names, if the name alone doesn't just give you away. I mean, my name is Robbie Robertson. I ain't the best in the world, but I mean, good God, when you hear Bernie Madoff in that, I'm like, okay, come on now.
Madoff, because he made off with so much. And Willie Bioff. Interesting. Yeah.
If he was bought off, I'm going to laugh a little.
Even back in that time, they were making fun of his name too. They were writing his name the way it sounds. It wasn't spelled that way, but they were writing it the way it sounds. And so when Willie Bioff, this mafia guy, came down to Hollywood in the mid-30s, everyone in Hollywood's like, oh crap, he's gonna try and, like, air quotes, create a fake union and unionize the crafts workers down here. And so that's when our hero of the Disney Revolt, Art Babbitt, got excited and said, I don't want this man anywhere near the Disney studio. I'm going to create some sort of blockage to stand in the way of him and any Disney employees, camera operators, or anyone else. And so he goes to Roy Disney, Walt's brother, who's the business guy. And then Roy says, you want to talk to the vice president, Gunther Lessing? Gunther Lessing is the head of, well, anything union related, he's the lawyer. And so Art Babbitt talks to Gunther Lessing, and Gunther Lessing says, here, read this book on unions, but don't read that part, just read this part. And so Art Babbitt read this part and that part. He read the whole book on unions, and he said, okay, I guess we need to start this, like, roughly organized community group. And the more he started getting this group organized to block Willie Bioff, the more it starts to turn into a union. And the more he started learning about unions, and then he got a union lawyer. And then the more he realized that, oh, this union that I'm starting, it's a company union. It's a fake, bogus BS union, because it was started by management. It was started by Gunther Lessing. Gunther Lessing kind of promoted this. He came to the meetings. This is BS. A true union has to be independent of management. It has to be led by an organization outside of the company. And so he kind of, Art Babbitt at that point felt like a patsy, felt like a stool pigeon, felt like he was being used by the company. And so he said, well, screw that. I don't like that. I don't like the way I was treated. I don't like the way that I was manipulated. I'm going to join this independent union called the Screen Cartoonist Guild, which already exists. They already have people at MGM. MGM, you know, they, at the time they were doing, or they were working on the first Tom and Jerry cartoon, which would go on to win like 7 Oscars.
Their 100th anniversary is coming up here soon.
MGM, happy birthday, MGM. Art Babbitt, by the way, for the listeners out there in Radioland who aren't familiar with the name, he was at the time Walt Disney's top animator. This is the top guy at the Disney studio who's telling them that you have been manipulating me for like 2.5 years, and I'm going to go and join and lead the Disney branch of this independent union and bring with me hundreds of Disney animators who are also frustrated. Now, the reason why these other animators and artists and inkers and painters are frustrated is because they've seen other wages, like at MGM, which has a union, go up, and their wages are less. They're being paid less working on Fantasia than the MGM artists are working on Tom and Jerry.
Didn't Fantasia force layoffs?
At the time, Fantasia led to a big deficit in the Disney company's account because they were counting on an overseas market picking up some of the slack of this expensive project. And it came out, you know, unfortunately, right as Europe was under siege by the Nazis. So Pinocchio lost money, Fantasia lost money, because they both came out in 1940 and the European market was about half of the total income.
Was that part of the good neighbor policy?
No, it wasn't. The good neighbor policy led to films like Saludos Amigos and The Three Caballeros. Good question, though. Should I talk about them for a minute so we can get on?
Yeah.
Okay, so that we're gonna jump forward a little bit. Fantasia came out in 1940. Pinocchio came out a little bit earlier in 1940. By the time the U.S. Joining the war in December 1941, that's when President Roosevelt said, okay, the countries in Central and South America, we don't want them to side too far with the Nazis. We want them to side with the United States and the Allies. So we're going to send some pop culture, bastions of goodwill down there. And so they sent some singers and some actors, and they sent Walt Disney and a staff of artists down to Central and South America and Mexico to create good press and to show how friendly the United States is with the other Americas. And that led to the 1943 film Saludos Amigos, which is like basically a Disney goodwill tour of South America. And that also led to the 1945 film The Three Caballeros, which is a goodwill tour of Mexico and its like neighboring countries, Guatemala. So the government paid Disney to make this trip and really helped Disney, the company and the man, bail out of this financial deficit from losing so much income, so much revenue, I should say, from the war in Europe. It really kept them afloat.
Now, what would your perspective be like if you were, since you've examined all this, if Art Babbitt didn't step in to kind of put that wall in between the union and just, I would say, I'm going to say nefarious characters, but what do you expect? Do you expect it would last as long, or did you expect maybe it wouldn't have the impact that it did because of him? I mean, he was able to talk to Walt's brother. I mean, so he's got some type of connection and loyalty involved in the business, obviously.
Yeah, Art Babbitt had been there since 1932. Like, that's a long time, from 1932 to like through Snow White. He was a lead animator on Snow White. He was one of the top guys. He was definitely one of like the like Walt's brain trust. He was in story meetings. He wasn't a storyboard artist. He wasn't part of the story team, but he and other top animators were brought into story meetings. He was in like publicity photos for some of these cartoons because he was just like such a top guy. And
why didn't he talk to Walt, though? That's the thing. I feel like you want to talk to the main honcho.
I don't know. I guess Walt was busy that day. There's plenty of times when he has talked to Walt. There are plenty of anecdotes and plenty of film footage of him talking with Walt. But this was more of just like a business decision, not a creative decision. And maybe everyone knew Walt was already kind of a temperamental artist type of guy. Sometimes he would come in super friendly and sometimes he would come in kind of fierce and frustrated. He was very mercurial that way. They also knew he was consumed with creative choices. So let's see, this was right after Snow White. Why didn't he go to Walt? Walt was probably busy doing like story meetings or watching pencil tests in the sweat box. That was his main task as the creative head of the studio. Go like leading story meetings and watching test animation and giving notes. The rest of the time, he's like leading the company and like making creative decisions on like merchandise and making creative decisions on this brand new studio they were building. He started building this studio in Burbank right as the Snow White money came in. So Walt was a very singular-minded kind of guy, and if he's on the track of one idea, it's hard to diverge that from another one or divert that from another idea. So at the time, he was probably consumed with his new studio that he was building in Burbank, and bringing this up would probably not get the results he wanted. Babbitt wanted, so Babbitt probably went to Roy's Walt's brother Roy for that reason to talk to him about what are we going to do about this business idea? These guys want to take over the business. How do we block these mafia?
Do you think that if Disney wasn't so getting so massive or just on this uphill, that if it was a little bit smaller of a company, that he would have been more in touch with his employees and there wouldn't have been a whole strike in the first place? Because he seems like the whole loyalty thing, but he seemed, from what I've kind of learned about Walt, is that he's very personal and people were his family. I mean, that's how Disney markets today is your Disney family. I've talked to plenty of employees from there. They don't talk bad about Disney at all. They love it. And there's, I know plenty of friends that are adults that go to Disney all the time and are, pass holders. But that loyalty and that family kind of structure that he embraced into his company, I would have to think that if it wasn't such a big company, it wasn't consumed by so much, that he would definitely have talked to his employees and got them any needs that they wanted filled.
You know, Rob, you're absolutely right. And that's something that they even brought up then in some of their transcript meetings, or meeting transcripts, I should say. I uncovered these private conversations, these like transcripts of word for word conversations and meetings that happened in and around the strike, because there were lots of secretaries who were basically like they specialized in writing and typing up transcriptions of what happened. This is before you can just like press record on like a handheld device and just like record a meeting. So in these conversations, especially one that happened around 1940, which was maybe 7 months before the strike, these top artists are saying themselves that Walt has gotten so big and the company has gotten so big that the smaller folks are being kind of overlooked. The smaller folks, like the people at the lowest rungs, like painters and inkers, and that it's not fair, and that Walt is very generous with the people who are visible and most visible, like the animators, who he considered to be like the movie stars of the studio. Very generous. He was giving these people the equivalent of like a six-figure income by today's standards. A six-figure animator who was maybe 28 years old sounds awesome. But then you have like these inkers and painters who are just struggling to get by during the Great Depression. So when you have people at that time pointing that out, that the company has gotten so big that Walt is overlooking like the people at the lowest rungs, it makes you wonder. The very thing you're bringing up, Rob, that like if the company was smaller, would he have noticed that its people are struggling? And I would say without a doubt he would have noticed it. He was probably just so consumed with the growth of his company then that these people got overlooked. But I know animators in today's day and age who have chosen smaller studios because they didn't want to have the burden of a large corporate entity. J.J. Settlemyer is an animator here on the East Coast. He animated the first season of Beavis and Butthead for MTV, and he went on to do a bunch of great animation for Saturday Night Live. But he scaled down. He was like, no, bigger is not better. I want to keep it small and manageable. So for not everyone, bigger is better.
Can I ask what your personal opinion is on the just impact of animation? Because obviously, like even when the reason why I started looking into the Disney subject in the first place is there's obviously been these generational shifts where animation has kind of taken different forms. But specific characters my grandparents loved, considered specific characters my parents love, considered the specific characters I love. There's the same ones, Mickey and Goofy and Donald, Disney, like kind of the main ones. But then there's also other characters that are growing up that have different personalities and has really evolved. I'm just curious what your perspective is on the impact of animation into our culture, not specifically just Disney, if you have other examples, but just the impact that it had in our culture today and the history.
Same thing with comics. I think like the idea that something is just for children is such a it's been disproven, but only in the like in the last 30 years, I think it's like it's been disproven that things are just for children. Whether it's cartoons, comics, animation. I think the things that touch us when we're young, that touch our creativity and touch our hearts, those are the things that are timeless. So maybe animation is the most evergreen sort of medium that we have. But then also you have like Del Toro's awesome quote where he says, "Animation is a medium, not a genre." So there's no reason why animation needs to be just for kids either. It just seems to have sort of, at least in the United States, been allocated to that. But you go outside the United States, you go to Japan, you go to France, and you see animation being told, being used to tell adult stories since the 70s.
I think it's a set and setting type thing. I think when we look at it being set for kids is because kids don't have to worry about work and have to go out and do other what adult things. But look, like I can look at my grandfather who watched cartoons, Mickey Mouse cartoons all the time in his old age, just because he was retired. He didn't have anything to go out and feel like he needed to go do. He was able to actually sit and relax and be a kid if he wanted to go back to being a kid or something like that. So I think it's just the set and setting.
Yeah. There's a timelessness about it, and there's an appeal to it. Scott McCloud, in his book Understanding Comics, writes about how the more simple the character is drawn, the easier it is for us to sort of enter the role of the character, to see ourselves as the character.
Now, do you believe anybody was influencing Walt Disney when it came to just the stuff going on with the strike? Like Gunther, you mentioned him. He sounds like a very Al Pacino in that Devil movie. I hate to put an example like that, but
Oh my goodness. What movie is that?
like Devil's Lawyer or something like
Devil's
that.
Lawyer.
Something, I don't know. It's got Keanu Reeves. That's all I know. And he still looks young, but.
Yeah. Anyone else besides Gunther Lessing influencing Walt Disney in that? Nothing exists in a vacuum. And that's kind of what I wanted this book to really say, that everything has influences from all over the place. At the time, there was left-wing media, there was right-wing media, just like it is now, except back then it was newspaper columnists. And there were newspaper columnists who said that all unions are mafia-led and communist-led. So everyone was sort of like slandering everyone. So if you're Gunther Lessing and you want to convince your boss that all unions are bad, you just show them this recurring column by this guy and that says that all unions are evil, that says that all unions are unconstitutional, and that they're all communist led, that they've the or that they're all mafia led, that the mafia like infiltrated these unions. The fact that, just like in any time, you have people who are fighting against the rising tide. During the beginning of World War II, before the US joined the war, there were American firsters who said, "Why should America step into World War II? The Nazis aren't that bad. Think of the cost. Think of the cost." These people were kind of business heads. And so you have these American firsters who were finally won over when Pearl Harbor was bombed. There are different opinions of all sorts of events, of all sorts of different times. And if you choose to focus on one, it's easy to ignore the other. And that's where you get the chasm of different opinion that was happening by the time the strike erupted. We can sort of see a similarity today. It's easy to sort of get looped into an echo chamber today. And I think that was the biggest issue of the strike. I think at the beginning of the strike talk or the union talks, I think Walt would have agreed with the strikers. I think he would have said, yes, my artist needs to, not the strikers, they weren't strikers at the time, but the union folks. He would have said, yes, my artists deserve to feel secure. They deserve to feel like their job is of value and that I value them. Loyalty can work two ways.
It's got to be part of being a part of a company too. When you get that big, people just like to feel connected to their boss at a point. It's why I've always worked for smaller companies. I just want to feel like, hey, you know what my name is. I appreciate that.
Oh my God, that's exactly something that they brought up. Something that Walt brought up during a meeting like 3 months before the strike in February 41. That he says, I know I'm not accessible as I used to be. People say, I want to talk to Walt. Well, I'm just so busy with so many other things right now. So I don't know. Maybe you should have gone into Time Machine and talked to Walt about how to run a company, because he is discussing the very same thing and how kind of like disconnected it is for an employee from to kind of relate to the boss once a company gets so big. At that point, it was like 700 people.
Where were you able to find your material for the book? Like you mentioned, going through transcripts and things of that sort. Was that something that was in the archives, or did Disney give you any information on that? I think you've mentioned in an interview already that Disney really didn't respond back to you on anything after you had sent your book over to them.
Yeah, that's true. Disney did not hinder. Disney didn't really help. I think they just wanted to see what I was doing, making sure that I was all in the up and up and that I could back everything up, which I totally did. I love the company. I mean, the history of the company I love. I love the artwork of the company, and I've the utmost admiration for Walt Disney. And I did not want this book to be bashing Walt Disney. I wanted to sort of like complement the information that is already out there. So if you go to like the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco, you'll see a whole permanent exhibit about the strike on the second floor. You'll see film, you'll see copies of signs, protest signs, picket signs. You'll see actual newspapers reporting the strike. This is all out on display any hour of the day that the museum's open. You can see it yourself. And I just wanted people to kind of get the whole story, since the Disney Family Museum is already unafraid of promoting this story. So the Disney company did not help that much. They helped with two tiny bits of information. And one of them was Gunther Lessing's start date, which I found to be very useful. But most of my research came from three main sources. One came from Art Babbitt's widow, who saved everything. Babbitt had saved everything by the time he died, which was 1992. But I kept visiting her. She lived in Hollywood, and I visited her every summer for years, digging through their archives and taking pictures and making copies of stuff. And there was just so much stuff that Art Babbitt had saved. Contracts and audio interviews and film strips that he had shot in the 30s at Disney, just like a treasure trove of stuff. So there was that. Second big source was this university library, CSU, California State University, which has some incredible stuff. Someone had just kept records of like every day's handouts and pamphlets during the strike. So during the strike,
we make fun of the pack rats, but thank God they exist.
Thank God. You need that. You need at least one person keeping records. So it was incredible to watch, to sort of organize these documents by date and just see the progression from, let's say, the beginning of 1940, from January 1940 through May, to see like how these people are getting riled up and what's going on a day-to-day basis of the strike. And I was able to map it all in a calendar, which I put online for free for anyone who wants to see. It's on the DisneyRevolt.com. You can look at a timeline, and there are copies of all the documents, all the original documents that I found in all of my sources, put there in chronological order, so you can yourself trace the events of the strike.
You transcribe those and put those online?
I didn't transcribe them. I scanned them.
Oh, scan them, yes.
Yeah, they are as you would see them.
Good for you, man. I've tried to scan in some documents. It's not an easy thing to do.
I just wanted to share this. I kind of wanted to put it out there to say, look, these things happened. Here's the evidence. I'm not out to bash the company. I'm here just to fill in some gaps of knowledge.
Was that a difficult thing for you, being a Disney fan, to not try and bash the company? Because obviously, there's probably a lot of myths out there about Walt Disney. I can only, from what I know about Disney, I've only been able to read on the FBI's website. That's as far as I've gone is the 700 parts on Walt Disney, besides maybe a biography on his life. I know his dad was, I don't know if it was speculated that he was a socialist or something like that, but
He
there's
was.
just...
Walt said, he said, my father was a socialist.
So there's like I said, there's probably a lot out there about Walt Disney or about the Disney company in general. That's why I was interested in learning your perspective on it. But was it difficult for you? Did you come across anything that gave you hesitation because you do like the company? You didn't want to bash the company. I think you didn't include in the book.
I wanted to make sure that it was even-handed. I wanted to give everyone a legit voice. It wasn't hard because I have such affection for unions and such affection for Disney. You know, being a kid with conversations about the teachers union around the dinner table, it was just something that was just part of life. The union was just part of employment. And growing up and watching Disney cartoons like every darn day and falling in love with Disney cartoons, that was both of these things are part of my DNA. Like, I wanted to say in the book, like by creating the book, I wanted to say that you can appreciate the Disney strike and appreciate Walt Disney both at the same time, because stories are complicated. The reason why stories are complicated is because they're made up of humans, and humans are complicated. Walt Disney is complicated. Art Babbitt is complicated. Nothing is ever black and white. I think that's the most important thing to get out of any sort of world event. I think today maybe people are too quick to simplify things and saying this is all good, this is all bad, without getting deeper into seeing how everything is just a human story. And this is why I went from this feeling of just asking questions, can we have a union, to this severe distress and acrimony of like, these people are bad and those people are awful.
How did the strike officially end?
At the beginning of August, Roy agreed to bring in an arbitration specialist from Washington, D.C. And Roy was acting independent of Gunther Lessing. Gunther Lessing was more Walt's crony at that point. And Walt trusted him entirely, would do pretty much anything that Gunther said. And Roy thought a little bit more discriminatory. And once it was clear that the U.S. would not fund this Good Neighbor project that we talked about until this strike was resolved, Roy said, okay, we're going to resolve it. He puts Walt on a boat, on a ship, with a bunch of artists to work on this Good Neighbor project. And he brings in this person to arbitrate the strike. To arbitrate basically means to settle it, to settle the strike. So, and in like someone who doesn't side with either the company or the unions. And so that's when it was settled. And it was settled by this person for the federal government. And it was it was settled in order to allow the strikers to have their strike. He accounted for them to as consisting of the majority of Disney artists. If you had a majority, you were by definition allowed to have a union. The big question was, for months, do these strikers consist of the majority of artists? And there was this argument back and forth. Apparently they did, but only by an extremely slim margin. And the Disney company would argue, no, they don't. And the reason why they would say that is because Gunther Lessing fired a bunch of union activists and a bunch of union members from the Disney studio, which is kind of against the law. You can't discriminate against people for union activity. But he said, we fired these 25 union guys, so they don't count as employees. So the actual employees who are union members are the minority. They're like, nah, it doesn't work that way. Homie, don't play that. So it was settled. It was settled with someone who came in from Washington, D.C. to arbitrate it and did it in favor of the unions, of the animation union, of the artists.
Can you plot a point if the work from the workers after the strike was over with, did it change? Did it get better? Did it get worse? Or was there a lull in the period afterwards?
The work? You mean like the actual product they were making, the animation?
Either the animation, or I mean, I would have just had to feel like it'd be hard working for a company, even if you won the strike after all you went through after that. I mean, obviously, Walt must be feeling some type of distrust from it or feel like some type of betrayal from it. It doesn't have to be nefarious or evil, but obviously that's going to impact the company, whether it's for a few weeks or a month or a year.
No, you're absolutely right, Rob. That's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. Walt kind of removed himself from like butting up to his staff at that point. Something had shifted in Walt and he sort of lost his interest in the artistry of making films. Like he, up till then, he was like deeply entrenched in making shorts and making these films, the short cartoons and making these feature length films. After the strike, it was all about just staying afloat. And the company did not really become financially solvent again until 1950 with Cinderella. So it took a long time. It took a long time for Walt to feel secure. And he was invested in Peter Pan. Like the artist said, like Walt's old magic was back. The spark in his eye was back with Peter Pan. He just loved Peter Pan. Part of that was because he was kind of when he was a very little kid, Walt was in a Peter Pan play. Just kind of like the way when he was a young teen, he was enamored by the silent film Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Walt always wanted to tap into what it was like to be a child, to be like enraptured by these fairy tales. But and he was always involved. He was always involved in story meetings. He was always involved in like a lot of creative decisions, but around that time, once Cinderella came, and Walt said, let's just make another Snow White. We need a moneymaker. Let's make another princess movie. Snow White was such a hit. Let's do it again. So he did that. And then, you know, by the early 50s, TV was becoming a household thing. And so Walt just like leaned into TV. He was like, I'm going to be a TV star. I'm going to put my work on TV. And he did, and his TV programs were great. And he became like a TV baron. And then the parks started to become a vision in his eye. And he said, I'm going to make a theme park. People are like, what's a theme park? He's like, I'm going to show you. And he made Disneyland. So there wasn't the kind of closeness, especially around making animated films, as there was before the strike. And after everything kind of shifted, there was like a cultural shift for the artists too. There was kind of an unspoken policy that you don't need to clock in, just get your work done. And after, well, like leading up to the strike, there were people who were like watching how much time and how many resources, pencils and things, the artists were using because they were working on such a tight budget because of the war in Europe. And so the artists were like, time clocks. Why are we, these like time specialists are like wandering the halls like a goody two shoes hall monitor and making sure that we're doing, this is not conducive to like creative growth. A lot of them didn't like the new studio. They felt the new studio was kind of too, I don't know, like it was too clean and too corporate. Yeah, too much of a grid. Too clinical, and that the old studio was kind of a hodgepodge of buildings of different sizes and different shapes. And to get from one place to another, artists would have to maybe traverse through a bunch of other departments to get there. So you're constantly like seeing what other departments are doing. And maybe you're running into people in the halls and having conversations and sparking ideas.
It's giving me anxiety already. No, just kidding.
Well, the new studio in Burbank was like a campus. This building does this, that building does that. Everything's in a grid. And some of that spontaneous whimsy of just the layout was lost. So when they first moved to that new studio in 1940, there were all these great perks. There was like a coffee shop that would deliver ice cream sodas to your desk. There was an auto shop where you drive your car in and they give you a free tune-up. There was a gym on top of the animator's floor where you can just go in and work out. If you earned enough money, that was another thing. If you earned enough money, you got all bunch of special perks. And if you didn't, you did. So that's another line of contention that made a lot of artists upset. That why was it a class system among artists within the Disney studio? Why didn't they get, while we're all on the subject, you and I, Rob, a lot of them were counting on a bunch of bonuses from Snow White. Profit sharing, that just didn't happen. The studio promised profit sharing and then they withdrew the promise. So that happened too. And for some people, that was enough. Getting a big new studio was enough. And for others, the studio was not what they wanted. They wanted the bonus in their paycheck.
Do you believe the Disney kind of went out of actual Disney? Like the Walt side of things really kind of faded away from the actual thing that we know as Disney. It became more of a market kind of capitalist kind of strategy. I mean, there's a lot of good marketing that they've had. And I'm not downplaying Disney at all. I just think it would have been a little bit different if we wouldn't have had the strike, or there wouldn't have been a strike. I know it doesn't really get talked about. It's the first time I discovered it was your book. But really, when you look at the kind of change that we talked about with Walt, I just feel like it would have been on a worse path. I don't know. But to me, it just seems like, I don't know, it became more money, 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 how the world kind of goes with a lot of good things. It kind of turns sour a little bit. But not saying they're bad now. I'm just saying. I wonder about if it would have stayed a small company, but still had the impact it still had. Would it be more personable and something of that sort?
I think if it had stayed small, it never would have been able to make the feature films. I think that's one thing.
Do you think TV helped it or hurt it?
Helped the Disney company?
Yeah.
Oh, it definitely helped. They had big hits, man. Davy Crockett was a big hit. Zorro was a big hit. Not to mention like, Walt's Wonderful World of Color and all of these other like Walt Disney Presents, and Disneyland was the name of a show. Talk about cross promotion. Like all of these shows where Walt gets to be the host, and now your host, Walt Disney, right? Walt Disney was the host of this show, and he's taking the viewers into this kind of fantasy world that they loved. It was a very successful and well-made series of shows. Walt didn't hold back on any expense.
I can't even text and eat cereal at the same time. So this guy's making theme parks and TV shows and movies. And I'm just like, that's too much at once. I'd have to do like one at a time.
he was nonstop. He worked nonstop. I don't think that strikes are good for, they're not good for relationships between bosses and employees necessarily, but it did help for studios like Warner Brothers. There was a walkout. It almost became a strike walkout where the boss said, if you want to bring a union here, I'm going to lock you out and force you to not come to work. And then there were talks between that guy who ran the Warner Brothers animation department and the guy who ran the independent animation union. And that was settled within 2 days. And then everyone went back to work and went to making Bugs Bunny cartoons. So it doesn't have to be bitter. But when you are at odds with someone, it's easier to keep people on your side if you demonize your opponent.
Yeah.
I don't know. There doesn't seem to be a lot of thought after that about going back to work with that guy, you know? I'm going to demonize you. It's like when you picture, I don't know, like boxers or wrestlers demonizing the other. And then what if after the match, not that I'm you know, a person who watches either of these sports religiously or anything, but after the match, you have to go and like, you know, work together. You know, how does that even, how does that function? How does it function to like demonize your opponent and then return to work with them? It's just, it's a weird thing in the brain. I don't know.
I mean, do you feel like you have a better love for Disney after learning all this, or do you just kind of understand that Disney's not, I guess, exempt from real world problems when it comes to capitalism and business?
Well, I think if you read the book, if your listeners out in radio land read the book, a lot of names will come alive. And if you watch a classic Disney film like Snow White or Pinocchio or Fantasia, you'll see these characters on the credits, and then something will click and you'll see, oh, it's people who make these films. And I know who this guy is. I know who Art Babbitt is because I followed his path and when reading the Disney Revolt. I know who Bill Tytla is because I followed his path when reading the Disney Revolt. And one by one, all these names will start to sort of like come alive, was my intention when writing this book. All these people who built the art of animation from the ground up. I think because the market was speaking, Walt Disney kind of ignored capitalism for a good while. His goal didn't seem to be to make money for a long time. He just wanted to get his films out there, and he just wanted enough money to afford the next film. When we're talking about 20s and into the 30s. He wasn't out there to make a profit. By comparison, there are animators or animation heads at the same time working elsewhere that work like clearly out just for a profit. And our guy, Art Babbitt, worked for one of those guys. That man is Paul Terry, who Art Babbitt worked for. And Paul Terry wanted to churn out a cartoon every week. Didn't matter if it was good. He didn't have a writing team. Didn't matter. He didn't test animation. It didn't matter. He just needed to put a film out once a week, once a week, once a week. It had to be exactly 6 minutes. Anymore, it was a waste of film. Anymore, it was a waste of paper and time and pencils. So that was Paul Terry. Paul Terry is the guy who would later on make Mighty Mouse, Heckle and Jekyll. But back in the 30s, it was all about just churning out a cartoon every week. By contrast, Walt Disney was doing pencil tests. He was making test animation. He had a story team to figure out how to give characters personality and how to make engaging stories rather than just a series of stupid gags. And so he turned out a cartoon every 3 weeks, selling it for as much. You know, theaters are buying copies of your film for as much, whether it's well made or poorly made. And so Walt Disney was like, we will just win them on quality, quality over quantity. And so he just kept turning out quality product. And that ended, I guess, when the strike happened, because the idea that like we can make, not right during the strike, but from like Snow White to the strike that ended. Snow White was such a big moneymaker that it was clear that the priorities of Walt and Roy changed. That they're holding back on these profit sharing bonuses so they can begin, I guess, building what would become an empire. And that just changes in the policies, changes in what they, it's like in their process, all of that led to just realizing that it took a while, but we can actually make a profit from this. It was said at the time that the only two people to make a profit from animation were Paul Terry and Walt Disney. Paul Terry, who just churned out quantity over quality by far, just flooded the market with crappy animation. And Walt Disney, who took a third of the time and sold a third of the films and made them excellent.
Jake, you've given me enough of your time, man. I really do appreciate you talking to me on my podcast about your book and a lot about just Disney in general as well too. Is there a place where people can find any of your links?
They can go to the DisneyRevolt.com, and you can buy your copy of the Disney Revolt on any of these links. You can buy it straight from ChicagoReviewPress.com. You can go to the DisneyRevolt.com and look at a bunch of free material sources of like some of the sources that I found, I just scanned and just put up there for anyone free of charge, including the court documents when Walt and Art Babbitt went to court against each other. And there's a who's who if you want to see pictures of some of these people we're talking about, like Art Babbitt and Gunther Lessing. That's up there. And you can find me on jakesfriedman.com.
I'm going to link all your links in the description. It's been a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for our next episode.